Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. It's Thursday, and we've got a great show planned for you today. My name is Mark Shiver. We so appreciate you listening and being part of the podcast. I want to remind you that you can follow us on Twitter at WhatMattersNC and on Facebook, facebook.com/WhatMattersNC. And you can also get yourself involved with my Twitter activity at Mark Shiver. Well, Jesse Jackson has made a suggestion, a request, a plea, as it were, to President Obama, and that is that he should go ahead and pardon Hillary Clinton, issue a blanket pardon to Hillary Clinton before he leaves office, much in the same manner as President Gerald Ford did for Richard Nixon. Now, we're not sure exactly what the pardon would be for. There's no specific charges as of yet pending that we're aware of for Hillary Clinton, but the Reverend Jesse Jackson would like for President Obama to go ahead and just blanket pardon, it's all good, and, you know, do that on the way out the door. So, interestingly enough, Jackson says, Hillary Clinton has not been tried, but there are those who want to drag her for the next 3 years. It will not stop until they find a reason to put her in jail. That would be a travesty. He goes on to note that President Nixon wasn't convicted of a crime. He didn't apply for a pardon. President Ford did it because he thought it would be best for the country. Jesse Jackson making those comments in Michigan. So how do you feel about that? Do you think that President Obama should go ahead and just issue a blanket appeal to Hillary Clinton? How does that work anyway? Does that cover parking tickets, DWIs potentially, email servers leaking classified information? You know, is it the whole, just you're good to go for anything and everything that you ever have done or might do? Interesting. We'll see if President Obama does that. I would think, if I were a gambling man, I would bet that he probably will do something like that. But we'll see. You know, there was no real love lost between Obama and Hillary, so we'll see if he does that for her on the way out the door. Now, you've heard about Uber, and you've heard about Lyft, and all these ways that you can make money. Well, now, if you don't feel like driving, you can make money protesting. Craigslist is apparently replete with ads that you can make $1,500 to go out and protest President-elect Trump. And we've seen these ads in Philadelphia, I think, Boston, some other areas. But kind of brings into mind the question, are these protesters like really American people who are angry about President-elect Trump? Or are these agitators, professional organizers, and people that do this sort of thing, kind of like we see at Moral Monday, and now they're having to pay people to show up and stage these protests? So, you know, if you're a little short on cash, just want to make some quick money, you can stand in the street and holler about Donald Trump and pick up some quick cash there. Just check out Craigslist. You know, it's really sad, folks, because what we've been talking about since the election here, and we've covered the post-election analysis, I think probably better than any outlet that I'm aware of. We have talked with the leading political science professors and pundits in the state. Today we'll have Garrett Ventry, who is a Republican communication strategist, and kind of talk about the branding that went on and the messaging and lack of messaging that we saw from the Clinton campaign. So we've covered it here, but what I haven't really mentioned and what I want to kind of drive home today is that this is America. We have a transfer of power. And it is accomplished by people voting. That's it. It's awesome. It's America. It's what people fight and die for all the time, who put on a uniform to protect our freedoms in this country, one of the most important of which is our right to vote. And so we have a peaceful transfer of power every 4 years. Sometimes it's every 8 years if the sitting president is reelected. But the bottom line is the people of this country spoke. They went to the polls and they voted and they said, okay, we don't like the direction the country is going in. We don't like the concept or the notion or the possibility of 4 more years of Obama policies. So they voted for Donald Trump. Instead of protesting, people should be celebrating because this is America. This is how it's done. People aren't in the streets with machine guns and tanks and you know, in some of these dictatorships where all of the elections are just a total farce. This is America. Peaceful transfer of power, and it's awesome. Did I like it 8 years ago when Barack Obama was elected? Not necessarily. I didn't particularly want him to be president. I didn't think he was qualified. But I didn't whine and cry and go stand in the street with a sign. I got up. I went to work the next day. And that's what millions of Americans are doing. But the media, who, by the way, have been totally discredited through this whole election process, have nothing better to do now than to cover these protesters, many of which are paid, who really don't care about the issue. They're just picking up some money. So, folks, let's just, okay, we had the election. Let's move on. Let's celebrate Thanksgiving next week. Let's celebrate Christmas. And let's see what a Trump administration will be like. Many people would say it can't be any worse than Obama. You know, what do we have to look forward to under Donald Trump? Well, hopefully a repeal and a replacement of Obamacare. You know, I've said before, I'm not for a wholesale kicking to the curb of people who have, you know, dreaded conditions that have insurance and suddenly yanking them out from under them. I don't think that would be very compassionate. But at the same time, I daggone sure don't think we ought to be penalizing people for not having government insurance or any insurance. It's like driving a seatbelt. I'm not in favor of seatbelt laws. What? Hey, it's my car. If I want to wear a seatbelt, I should be able to. If I don't, I shouldn't be written up a ticket. Well, Mark, that's just stupid. No. It's conservatism, which I believe in strongly. The government doesn't need to be penalizing you or me or anybody else because we do or don't have insurance. And they don't need to be writing tickets for seatbelt violations. Well, Mark, you know, it drives up the insurance rates if people get hurt in auto accidents. Well, that's the point. Free market. Let the insurance company say, hey, stupid, if you're not wearing a seatbelt, we're not going to pay your claim if you're in a wreck. And then if you want to run that risk, that's up to you. Less government intervention, less government interference. That's what I'm looking forward to under a Trump administration. And we'll see if we have that or not. And guess what? In 4 years, we get to do it again. Another peaceful transfer of power. So let's get out of the streets, folks, and let's get to work and make this country, oh, wow, I was going to say make this country great again. But hey, let's make this country great again. Let's do it together and find good things to celebrate about our country, especially the fact that we can vote for who we want to vote for, by the way, and see the great vision of our forefathers come to life every 4 years. Well, as I said, we have a great show today. We do have Garrett Venture. We also have Brian Balfour of the Civitas Institute with some great insight about the argument between mean old rich people and the government. So we will look forward to that. And I'm going to get out of the way and get right to it. And thank you once again for listening to What Matters in North Carolina. Joining us now on What Matters in North Carolina, our good friend Garrett Ventry. He's involved in politics and strategy and communications and all that good stuff. And Garrett, welcome back to the program.
Mark, always a pleasure to be on. Thanks for having me, sir.
Well, I've been making the circuit with a lot of political science professors, but as someone who has their ear a little closer to the ground, I thought I would get your thoughts on the outcome of the election last week.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it's definitely a great time to be Republican here in North Carolina. You know, President-elect Trump and VP-elect Mike Pence obviously won North Carolina, very sizable here, and then they won nationally, which is huge and shows that, you know, the American middle class and the majority of voters are ready to move past the last 8 years of Barack Obama and some of the policies he's done and move in a different direction. And so definitely key there on the executive level. And then obviously we kept the Senate majority, and our senator here, Richard Burr, defeated Deborah Ross by a very large margin. And we kept it nationally as well. So we have the supermajority here, obviously, in the House and Senate in North Carolina. And then we've got the majority in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate nationally, which is key. We still have a majority of governors nationwide. And so we're going to get to pick at least one Supreme Court justice here over the next year. And we're going to have a new foreign policy with a new Secretary of State. We're going to have, like I said, just a different direction. So I think it's a great time to be Republican in North Carolina and nationally. Like I said, nationally, we're going to control all three branches of government. And then here in the state, I mean, obviously the governor's race is still contested, and we're still looking to find out, you know, what's going on there. And we'll probably have more information in the next coming weeks. But, you know, like I said, nationally here and just locally, it's a great place and great time to be Republican now. So big wins for us all across the board.
Garrett, in your experience as someone who is involved in communications and that sort of thing, the media really got it wrong, and so did a lot of the pollsters. Was the message somehow lost from the Clinton side of the equation in the midst of all of the anti-Trump and anti-Clinton fervor that we had? There really was no clear message that I could have recalled hearing from the Clinton side. You know, when Bernie Sanders was in the primary, there was obviously, agree with it or not, there was obviously a message, you know, socialism and kick out the bankers and all this kind of stuff. Clinton never really seemed to pull together any kind of theme that Democrats could rally around.
Correct. And Clinton ran on the whole basis that Trump was bad for America. We never really knew what she stood for, and she never really had detailed policies. So that was part of it. The second part of it is Americans just didn't trust her. Over 60% of Americans throughout the election process continued to find her untrustworthy. She lied multiple times about, you know, her emails with classified information, with whether or not the State Department allowed her to have it. Then they did, they didn't, but they did. I mean, so there's just a lot of going back and forth with that. But the voters wanted to change. I mean, I think it's over 70% of the people said the country was going in the wrong direction under President Obama. And, you know, Donald Trump ended up being the change candidate for that. He was an outsider, businessman, no political experience. And so I think, you know, what he was standing for in a lot of ways, people identified with smarter trade deals and, you know, wanting to, you know, bring things like term limits to D.C. and to cut taxes, have a stronger economy, wage war on terrorism, handle, you know, a lot of the border and immigration issues that a lot of middle-class Americans care about. And so I think he spoke to those things, and people were ready for a change. And so I think, you know, Secretary Clinton did a fine job, or campaigned in on a lot of the digital and advertising side. But as far as messaging, you know, it was really the two messages were, number one, you know, she could be the first female president, which is an exciting thing, but she would have been a disaster. And then the second part of it was how bad Donald Trump was, which her and the media teamed up to, you know, they were all over that message, especially the last few months of the campaign here. And so I think what people did is it was a rejection of the status quo with Hillary Clinton. I mean, she's been in D.C. for 25-plus years. She had, you know, her and her husband, Bill, had a lot of scandals over the last years here in their time in politics. And then people rejected the mainstream media. The media has been calling, you know, from McCain to Romney and now to Trump, and calling Republicans dangerous, racist, bigots, whatever you want to say or throw in that word. And I think it was a rejection of the mainstream media in a lot of ways, too, that you saw with Donald Trump's candidacy.
Well, I wanted to pull on that thread just a little bit more because he was really remarkably able to deflect the, you know, for lack of a better word, the October surprise, so to speak, that came out with him and Billy Bush and all of that, you know, horrible conversation that could really have taken his candidacy down. And I think the Clinton campaign tried to make that stick, but somehow he was able to, you know, get out from under that. And that's really whoever was running his campaign did an excellent job of basically steering the conversation away from that.
Yeah, I mean, Kellyanne Conway, his campaign manager, I'll give it to her. I mean, she's a fantastic campaign manager. She's fantastic at messaging and handling the press. And, I mean, what she did winning a major campaign as a female is absolutely astounding, and more people need to give credit there. She's really good at what she does, has great experience. But, yeah, I mean, in that Trump comment, I think you and I had talked about that before. I mean, it was completely inappropriate and wrong and needed to be condemned. I was glad to see people even within our party come out and say, hey, this is wrong. You even had that here in North Carolina where the governor and both Senator Tillis, Burr, the Speaker of the House, Tim Moore, all came out and said, hey, this is wrong behavior. And so I think what happened is that it happened so long ago, too. That was part of it. But I think another part of it was, you know, Trump said so many different things this campaign, where if there's any other candidate, they would have been done. But for some reason, he had this band of supporters that just believed in the overall message of what he was saying, and they weren't going to be deterred by, you know, the media or the Clinton camp saying that. Whether that's right or wrong, that's up to people to decide. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, he survived that. I mean, he looked like he was starting to tank in the polls there, but you know, he ended up pulling off one of the biggest political upsets that I've ever seen, to beat the Clinton machine when he was out fundraised. You know, the ground game, Clinton had a better ground game than him. And so, you know, definitely a political upset there, but he did survive. Definitely an interesting conversation, an interesting surprise there in October, like you said. But Kellyanne Conway did a fantastic job managing the campaign, taking over after Paul Manafort kind of had it in stagnant mode. So she did a fantastic job, and I'm interested to see where she ends up landing here in the next few weeks.
Yeah, that definitely will be interesting. You know, one thing I kept waiting for that you mentioned, and we're talking with Garrett Ventry, communications and strategist and all this kind of stuff in politics, and really has his finger on the pulse of all of that, but had I been running her campaign, meaning Secretary Clinton, I would have been just blasting from the mountaintops, first female president. And while it was there, it never was really, you know, front and center. Man, I'd have had commercials out there that, you know, people would have gotten sick of, really trying to drive that point home. And I kept waiting for it, and it never really emerged as the central, you know, rallying point of her campaign.
Right. Yeah, and she's just not an exciting candidate. I mean, number one, you know, Trump supporters definitely, you know, even in the polls, it was showing that they were just more enthusiastic about their candidate than Clinton supporters were about Clinton. And like I said, I mean, you can't really run as the change and the hope candidate. Now, Barack Obama in 2008 could do that. He was only a U.S. senator for a few years, was involved in state politics for a little bit. So he didn't have all this D.C., you know, experience and baggage. So he ran as a young outsider who overcame a lot as a young man and, you know, just a really inspiring story. So he was able to capture the nation there. You know, Hillary Clinton wasn't really able to do that. You know, when you were First Lady of Arkansas, First Lady of the United States, a U.S. senator, a Secretary of State, a millionaire, and you know, people knew you, and so you've been in D.C. doing this, and you're running as this change candidate for 25 or 30 years, and it's really tough to do that when you've been part of a lot of the problems in D.C. and you've been part of the political process for so long. It's hard to do that, and then insert Donald Trump comes, who no political experience, businessman, self-made billionaire in a lot of ways. And so it was definitely tough for her to inspire a lot of the middle-class families when you had a businessman who's promising to cut taxes and who's, been successful in the private sector. And so I think that was part of it that was tough for her running on that change aspect, that she was going to change D.C. after 8 years of Obama. She was running as a continuance of that when people said, hey, the country's heading in the wrong direction. A majority of people were saying that. And so she was running on this idea of, continuing Obama while changing things. And so it was just a tough message to sell. And like you said, I mean, the first female president thing, it's amazing. It would have been absolutely brilliant. And I hope we have a first female president here soon. After having the first African-American president, that's huge progress for our country in President Obama. And I'd love to see that, but Hillary Clinton would have been an absolute nightmare in my humble opinion. I think there's plenty of women who are qualified to be president, from Utah Congresswoman Mia Love to Governor Nikki Haley from South Carolina. There's definitely women who are qualified for the job and would be good at it. I think you're right, though. I mean, I think her message had to be experience and being able to take her experience and using it across the globe with trade deals and with foreign policy and with national security and really painting Trump as not experienced. But she wasn't able to do that very effectively.
Well, her commercials that ran on television and on the radio, I thought were outstanding, just, assessing quality of campaign advertising. Really surprised Trump was able to survive all of that. I mean, when you have him, in just soundbite after soundbite of some of the things that he said that, could really have hurt him. But it really is amazing that he was able to withstand all of that and emerge with such a resounding victory. And turning to North Carolina, Garrett, the Trump victory was, I guess, in some part responsible, although I don't think it's that responsible for what we saw in state for Republicans. I think that the General Assembly pretty much can stand on its own merits. And while a lot of people were predicting that there would be 8 to 9 House seats flipped to Democrat, we didn't see that happen. I think people are pretty pleased with what the General Assembly has been doing. And yet the wave went all the way down the Council of State. I mean, I'm just still stunned that June Atkinson, an entrenched bureaucratic incumbent veteran, was beaten by Mark Johnson, who really, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, but I mean, nobody knew who he was, and yet he ran a statewide race and beat someone of her stature. Also, Mike Causey, able to unseat Wayne Goodwin. Mm-hmm. So what happened with Governor McCrory? He was not able, as you mentioned, Senator Burr, the House and Senate, some of these Council of State races. And yet here's Governor McCrory still. He wasn't a clear winner, and he may or may not be. But why was he not able to participate in that Republican wave?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I mean, like you said, I mean, the General Assembly, people told us we might only keep 62 seats at one time. We might, lose the majority. And to be able to keep the supermajority and have 74 seats in a year where Democrats and the mainstream media and outside groups, were coming to North Carolina and tearing us apart over, obviously, House Bill 2. And Forbes came out with an article yesterday and said even in spite of HB 2 and even with HB 2 still and after HB 2, the North Carolina economy and business climate continues to be one of the best in the country. Jobs are continuing to come here. And so people are pleased with the North Carolina General Assembly. People on, the few people on Twitter might not tell you that. And, some of the Democratic House reps want to ignore the fact that this is the fact. When the Democrats had control of the General Assembly last, we had the 8th worst economy, 5th highest unemployment rate. Teacher pay was decreased from I think it was either 19th or 22nd, and it went all the way to 47th under their watch. So insert when the Republicans come in and take office, we've moved the needle. Teacher pay has moved in the right direction. The economy is one of the fastest growing. The business climate is one of the best in America. Taxes are lower than they've been in years, in decades, really. and more jobs are coming here. The economy continues to grow. And so people are seeing, hey, the Republicans, the Democrats can do whatever they want. They can distract with false information. They can try and push a narrative that's really not there. But the fact of the matter is this. We got over 200,000 more votes in the General Assembly than the Democrats did. When we took the majority in 2011, it was under maps drawn by the Democrats. So the people of North Carolina have spoken. They've spoken loudly that North Carolina Republicans and the legislature are doing a better job handling the economy, handling taxes, and balancing the budget than the Democrats had done. And so that's part of it there, and we had some resounding victories. And I think Trump helped with that a little bit, obviously. You know, some of the races and some of the closer races, I think he definitely helped there. But we definitely have done a lot of good work over the past 6 years here that people have seen and take notice of. And with Governor McCrory, I mean, it's an interesting situation. I mean, you would think if, you know, Trump won big here, Burr won rather large here, the lieutenant governor won here as well, pretty resounding, and we had some success there. It's very interesting. I'd like to see kind of if there was some ballot splitting, I don't know, but we're still kind of in this process of trying to figure out who will be our next governor. Obviously, Cooper has a little bit of a lead there, but there's still a lot of information that needs to be gathered, and there's still a lot of facts that need to be gathered and see who actually, after all these ballots and provisional ballots are counted at the end of the day, I guess we'll see who is the governor. But it's definitely interesting. You know, part of it may be to, you know, a lot of outside groups were spending here in North Carolina in the governor's race. So there was definitely some, you know, they were outspent there. And so we'll see, like I said, at the end of the day, what happens. Obviously, the people will prevail, and we'll see, you know, when the votes are counted, who the governor is, and that decision will be respected. But it definitely is interesting to see, you know, how Burr won in some of these council of states and legislators, but the governor still, you know, isn't decided yet the race, but it's definitely interesting to think about.
Our guest is Garrett Ventry. We're talking thoughts about the election and communications and that sort of thing. So from a standpoint of perception on the part of the public, Garrett, how long does Governor McCrory and the Republicans, how long do they drag this thing out before saying, okay, you know, we're done? Because I understand that the goal is to have a fair election and an accurate count. But at some point, I think people are going to get, you know, tired of it. And unless there's clear, overwhelming, sure, visible evidence that there was some type of miscount or wrongdoing, I think anything less than that is not going to be perceived very well.
Correct. I think you're right. And I think, it, you know, the absolute best outcome would be, regardless of who the winner is that the votes were done correctly, the people's voice will be heard, and the next governor will be either Roy Cooper or Pat McCrory. I think that's the best solution here, is that we find out, you know, make sure that the votes that were cast were good, and if those votes were cast, and regardless of the outcome there, that's the will of the people, and that's who needs to be governor. And so I think that's obviously the best outcome there. To be honest with you, I mean, I don't work for the McCrory campaign, so I'm not sure exactly, you know, what they're thinking, or I've heard, you know, they should have a decent idea sometime in the next few weeks. I don't know how accurate that is, but like I said, I mean, I think at the end of the day, like you said, I mean, that's what we want to make sure here, that the votes that are cast were accurate, and that you know, nothing shady was going on. And at the end of the day, you need to, regardless of who the winner is, whether Attorney General Cooper or Governor McCrory, you know, the votes need to speak for themselves, and that's who needs to be governor.
Our guest is Garrett Ventry here, talking about all things politics in North Carolina. We had Speaker Moore on a couple of days ago. He said not interested really in the General Assembly having to get involved. Correct. In that. You know, there's been some people have gone and dragged out the June Atkinson 2004-2005 right. Situation where the General Assembly named her the winner. Speaker Moore said, you know, really, no thank you as far as that goes. But in terms of the General Assembly, they've done so much in terms of tax reform, regulatory reform, and that sort of thing. What are you looking for over the horizon when they convene in January, as far as what do you think their focus is going to be?
Absolutely. That's a great question. I know they want to continue to focus on fostering innovation and entrepreneurship here in North Carolina. We've got great tech companies coming here. Charlotte and Raleigh are both ranked top 10 cities for tech companies and for digital. So I think they want to continue to focus on fostering entrepreneurship and innovation here. I think a second thing, they want to continue to roll back regulations on small businesses so they can continue to thrive and so they can continue to hire people. They can continue to bring jobs here and continue to provide for their family and start up new businesses. So that's part of it. I think they're going to look for different ways to provide continued tax relief. And then obviously deliver a good balanced budget, continue to raise employees and state employees and teacher pay over the horizon. They want to continue to do that and invest in quality education here. So I think those are some things you're going to see on the agenda. We want to continue to provide alternative way of doing things for the Democrats and a better way really here for North Carolina. We want to continue to provide, like I said, greater tax relief, rolling back regulations, job creation. I think those are things that the General Assembly really wants to focus on going forward here. Obviously, something could pop up in the session. No one was expecting in March there for, some of the things that came up here in North Carolina surrounding House Bill 2. But I think that's really going to be the driving force. And that's what Republicans want to focus on. We want to focus on, less government. We want to focus on, empowering people, continuing to put more money back into their pockets and continuing to create good paying jobs and better education. That's what we want to focus on. There's other things we really don't want to have to address. Now, when they come up, obviously there's things the General Assembly will just have to address, being the legislator, and those things come to you. You can't control that sometimes, but that's the overall message that Republicans want to send, that we want to create a prosperous economy and make North Carolina one of the best places to live, work, and play.
Well, very good. Excellent. Sounds like it should be a very interesting and always never a dull moment when the General Assembly is in town. Garrett, thank you very much for your time and your insight. I appreciate it, and look forward to having you on the show again real soon.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate it. Have a great one.
Thanks. You too. Well, it's always a pleasure to have Brian Balfour join us on What Matters in North Carolina. He is the Executive Vice President of the Civitas Institute. Brian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Well, you've obviously been busy with a lot of the election-related stuff, and yet you've taken time out to post a couple of interesting blogs on the nccivitas.org website, and thought we'd talk about those today. But before we jump into those, I've been asking everybody that comes on their thoughts about the election, and I'd love to get your thoughts, kind of a broad brush overview of what you thought of last week's election outcomes.
Right. Well, I'm sure I'm not the first one to bring this up, but the thing that jumps out to me, certainly here in North Carolina, is the contrast between Donald Trump carrying the state and Pat McCrory losing the state, well, at least as of where the votes stand right now. Obviously,
right.
That there's still a lot to play out there, but you look at certain parts of the state that there's certain counties and parts of the state where there's significant drop-off between the number of votes that Donald Trump received versus number of votes Pat McCrory got. So that's really, and you even, I know you wrote an interesting article kind of touching on that subject as well.
Yeah.
Highlighting where, and actually giving people some kudos who actually, agree or disagree with how they voted. They're at least putting some thought into the vote and not just reflexively just going down and checking off the same party for every race. So I think that certainly jumps out. Secondary to that, interesting to note, Dan Forrest, the lieutenant governor, winning fairly comfortably in his race, again, in contrast to what Governor McCrory did, and Dale Falwell winning the treasurer's race.
Yeah.
We've gotten to know Dale a little bit over the years in his work, and I think he's definitely got the right mind for that position.
Absolutely.
Had a lot of discussions about identifying some of the big issues going on in the Treasury Department regarding the state pension fund, which is not in nearly as good a shape as they try to tout it to be.
Yeah.
And of course, massive unfunded liabilities with the state health retiree benefits as well. So to me, certainly from that standpoint, the fiscal side of things, that was encouraging to see Dale Falwell. And then Department of Public Instruction, June Atkinson losing to what I think most people would probably consider a pretty relative unknown.
Yeah.
And Mark Johnson. And it would be really interesting to see what sort of actions that he takes place. So a lot of interesting changes are coming. And then, of course, if we do end up with Governor Roy Cooper teaming up with Josh Stein and his former Attorney General slot, what sort of, you know, they're going to be, Cooper would be pretty stymied by that veto-proof majority in the legislature,
right,
legislatively. But when you look at that Stein-Cooper coalition, what sort of things could they do through the courts?
Yeah,
and maybe circumvent the legislative process and achieve some things through the court. So that'll definitely be something to keep an eye on.
Well, I'm glad I asked you, because nobody has brought up that potential dynamic of using the courts as a way to stymie the General Assembly. You make a great point, Brian, because all the way up and down the ballot, again, Mark Johnson, I mean, how do you unseat a entrenched bureaucrat who's widely known in June Atkinson? And the name recognition for Mark Johnson certainly wasn't comparable to hers. And also Mike Causey, who's run multiple times, unseating Wayne Goodwin for insurance commissioner. And yet at the top of the state ticket, Governor McCrory not able to ride that wave, so to speak. It really is a fascinating dynamic.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely couldn't agree more. And, you know, I haven't done any specific numbers or digging deep, but you know, certainly noticing a trend in those state council of state races, I should say, trending more Republican. I mean, those have been really dominated for years by folks from the Democratic Party. So definitely moving into a little bit of a different dynamic there as well.
Well, if you look out over the landscape of the state, what I have really taken away from the outcome of the election is that people in North Carolina are not nearly as negative as the media and the left would try to paint them to be when it comes to the condition of the state. You know, the whole HB2 is just destroying the state and teachers are leaving in droves. And I think people are not buying that because, again, while Governor McCrory had his problems, the General Assembly is strongly Republican right now. And, you know, if anyone were to really take the blame for HB2, it would be them, because they passed the law. And obviously, Governor McCrory had to sign it. But if people were really ticked off about that, like we've been led to believe by the media, then I think we would have seen a different outcome. But I think people are smart enough to know that the state is moving in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's, you know, are you going to believe the media or are you going to believe your own eyes?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
If you see your communities, you know, see jobs being created and you look at the state's unemployment rate, which has been dropping pretty significantly over the last couple of years, and people going back to work and you know, you hear these horror stories about, like you said, teachers leaving in droves from the schools. But then when you look at the actual data, and then you're looking at like your children's schools, and you're saying, well, I'm just not really quite seeing it. You know, the attrition rates for teachers is really pretty consistent with past years. And
yeah,
actually there's more and more people moving to North Carolina. And guess what? Some of those people are teachers who are willing and wanting to work in North Carolina.
Exactly.
So, you know, the narrative and you know, that gets to a bigger, broader topic of, you know, the influence of the old kind of mainstream traditional media really being eroded by alternative voices out there, like your show, of course, you know, Civitas Institute and the information and the news that we provide and so many other various sources of news and information out there that I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, to have so many more choices and so many more different viewpoints and voices represented versus, you know, like when I grew up, it was the three main, you know, channels. And
yeah,
if you didn't like where they were saying, well, tough luck.
Yeah, you had nowhere to go.
You got nowhere else to turn. So this is, you know, it's a fantastic new day. And the mainstream media is, you know, their bottom line is being eroded by this, and they need to figure out, you know, maybe a different business model in a way to succeed in the new, you know, this new world of technology.
Well, I think truth might be
that's a good place
good
to start, right?
Point. So, speaking of truth, Walter Williams, who is a noted economist, and we've heard him on various radio programs, and certainly a very influential voice when it comes to kind of sifting between the realities of government influence and conservatism and economy and people being able to live their lives and be successful without government intervention and influence. He's written a new article that you posted, a review on some commentary at ncivitas.org. And it's really compelling, talking about the a comparison between the rich and the government. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I really enjoyed this article because Walter Williams kind of has a you know, plain spoken, you know, he's a very intelligent a guy in academia, but he also is able to write columns to relate to the common person and really just put things in blunt terms. So what Williams was writing about is basically kind of comparing and try to address, you know, a lot of people, especially on the left, they have these fears of, oh, the rich people have so much control over our lives. So he was looking at that and contrasting that versus the amount of power and control that government holds over our lives. And so one of the things he brings up as an example, you know, he talks about, for instance, Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates and the Amazon.com CEO Jeff Bezos, that are the two wealthiest people in the country. And so, and I'll just kind of read a quick little segment from the column because he just says it so well. So when he's referring to this, he says, with all the money that Gates and Bezos and other super rich people have, what can they force you or me to do? Can they condemn our houses to create space so that another individual can build an auto dealership or a casino parking lot? Can they force us to pay money into the government-run and doomed Obamacare program? Can they force us to bust our children to schools out of our neighborhood in the name of diversity? Can they force us to buy our sugar from a high-cost domestic producer rather than from a low-cost Caribbean producer? The answer to all those questions is a big fat no. And so he goes on to contrast, you know, these super rich, the wealthiest people in the country, they can't force you. They don't have any impact on your daily life like that. They can't force you, you know, tell you what school to send your child to or make you, you know, buy health insurance that you don't want to buy. All these things the government can do. And then he even breaks it down even further. He talks about even the amount of control or power like local bureaucrats have over your life. Say, for instance, if you wanted to start a shop in Main Street in your community, look at all the paperwork you have to fill out. Look at all the regulations. I mean, there's some community, the town that I live in, there's rules you have to follow in terms of the sign of the, or the size of the signage, you know, for your store.
Yeah.
And if you don't meet these rules and even, you know, forms that you fill out, if they're not approved by even just a local middle, lower level bureaucrat, I mean, your hopes of starting a business can be dashed by someone like that.
Yeah, that's an excellent, excellent comparison. And yeah, I mean, Bill Gates isn't telling you, you know, your sign can only be 8 feet by 7 feet, you know, or whatever. It's really interesting that people have been receptive to messages like those of Bernie Sanders, who really put the rich in the crosshairs. And of course, he's not poor, by the way, but and really try to create this class envy. And there's this nebulous, ethereal notion that somehow the rich are to blame for our problems. And yet, how many people does Bill Gates employ? How many people does Amazon employ? In fact, how many people does Bill Gates employ by extension? The people that sell Microsoft products and the people that service Microsoft products. I mean, it's endless in terms of the influence that his company has. And yet somehow the left would have us to believe that people like him who have been successful are the problem, you know, that needs to be dealt with in our country.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to make sure to differentiate, though, that, you know, these wealthy business owners, you know, they can become, you know, corrupted if they go and seek government privilege to gain the advantage. So we're making sure to clarify, we're not talking about, you know, crony capitalists here. We're talking about, you know, people who are running their businesses and achieving success without the help of special government favors. So, you know, getting back to you, yeah, of course, you know, Microsoft and Amazon, that, you know, thousands of people, they're providing them a living, you know, their employees, but also look at the customers, all the customers that use those products do so voluntarily and willingly versus government programs and government services that they allegedly offer to us. They're not asking our permission, you know, to charge us for what the government does. I mean, they're forcing us to pay taxes.
That's right.
So there's another really stark contrast. You know, Bill Gates doesn't have any authority to throw someone in jail if they don't buy Microsoft products.
Exactly.
Picture the other side of the fence there. If you don't pay taxes, the government does have the authority, you know, to come and ultimately throw you in jail if you refuse.
Yeah. No, it's a stark contrast. And if you don't want to buy, you know, a Windows-based product, well, then you can go buy an Apple-based product or something like that. I mean, there's freedom there.
Yeah, absolutely. And we purchase those products willingly because we feel it makes our lives better. We value that service, that good is going to provide to us to improve our lives. We value that more than the money we're giving up in exchange for it. Otherwise, that exchange wouldn't take place. You know, we wouldn't buy something thinking it's going to make us worse off, right?
Yeah.
So voluntary exchange, it's a win-win. You know, the consumers, they acquire something that they value more than the money. And then, of course, the business, they're acquiring our money so then they can go and produce more goods and services for us to improve our lives.
You know, this is so simple. And yet it seems like a lot of members of Congress and even in the state, they seem to forget these things in terms of core principles. Because, for example, in terms of Obamacare, there were a number of Republicans that could have done something, the majority that they've had, even though Obama, the president, would have vetoed any changes, likely, they haven't done anything. And so they have forgotten that the government can make people like me, who actually had to pay like $2,000 in a penalty for one of my kids, you know, which I had nothing to do with their insurance. And yet here's the government, you know, getting in my life and taking my money that I had earned. And yet some of these elected officials seem to be okay with that. And I think we need to re-educate some of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And, you know, at both sides of the aisle, they're all too willing, in my opinion, to use that power of government to try to accomplish these things, these programs. And, you know, getting back to, you mentioned like Bernie Sanders supporters and how folks like that become popular. Well, there's, you know, the sense of security is appealing to a lot of people. You know, they hear that siren song of, oh, well, I'm going to take care of you. Don't worry. You know, it's a rough and tumble world out there, but we'll have this government program take care mm-hmm. of your health care. We'll have this government program take care, make sure you're okay in retirement. We'll have this government program, you know, to make sure you have money to buy food and so on and so forth and free college and on it goes, right? And, you know, of course, it's a lot of these people, all they hear is, oh, well, that sounds pretty appealing. You know, that's, you mm-hmm. know, it's really risky to go out there and try to take care of myself and earn a living and take care of my family. You know, it's kind of nice to have that fallback where, you know, we have all these things that would be taken care of. But they don't really stop to think of, well, actually, who is paying for those things? And then that money, those people who are paying, having to support these government programs, well, guess what? That means they have less money than to offer you a job.
That's right.
And then, of course, then there's all the incentives at play where successful businesses are punished and having to pay more taxes to mm-hmm. support this welfare state. Then that means there's going to be fewer businesses started, fewer businesses expanded, and it kind of reinforces itself on this negative cycle, this negative downward cycle. And all of a sudden, we're left wondering, why are things so bad? Where's all my free stuff?
Exactly. And what people forget, Brian, and we're talking with Brian Balfour of the Civitas Institute here on What Matters in North Carolina, people forget that the money is not free. It's coming out of the pockets of you and me and everybody else that works and earns a living and pays taxes.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another way you know, we saw such stark divisions amongst people in this latest election. You know, what a great way to divide people than taking from some, you know, property and money that they've mm-hmm. justly earned. Didn't harm anybody, didn't steal from anybody. They put in an honest day's work and made some money. And then taking that forcibly against their will and then giving it as an unearned benefit to someone else who did nothing to earn it.
Yeah.
You know, what a great way to foster resentment on the person who's forced to pay and a sense of entitlement on the person receiving it.
Yeah.
You know, much, much better is a charity of a voluntary nature where people give you know, willingly to help people because of their charitable spirit and their nature, And then, you know, the people receiving it are more grateful because they know the people are willingly helping them out of the goodness of their heart.
Well, that kind of leads us into the another blog that you wrote entitled Harmony or Conflict, You Decide. And Jeffrey Tucker of the Foundation for Economic Education contrasts conflict versus harmony. I think we've seen a lot of conflict, you know, over the past several months and even ongoing after the election, people not really happy about the results on one side of the aisle. But talk about the difference between harmony and conflict.
Yeah, and what a couple of great points that Tucker was really drawing out is, you know, a lot of analysts are talking about look at how this election has divided us. You know, it's really you know, revealed just how divided we are as a nation. You know, those sort of comments. But Tucker gets to the point is, well, maybe, you know, maybe politics is not revealing it. Maybe it's helping to exacerbate these divisions amongst people. And he says, he puts it really well in his description. He says, quote, "You create a huge state and invite people to struggle for control over it. You extract trillions in revenue and have a contest for who gets the cash and on what terms. You create a gigantic regulatory machine and micromanage lives and suggest some use it against others depending on their preferences. You create you know, and from there you create more and more divisions and, you know, taking from some and giving to others. And, you know, so it's not like politics are necessarily, in his argument, are revealing how we're divided. It's politics that is doing the dividing. And so that's really what, you know, what he's making the argument, and it gets back to the things that we were discussing about, you know, taking from some, giving to others. You know, government is more about force and compelling people to do things against their will that they maybe rather would not have done, versus, you know, the voluntary portion of society where we interact freely and by mutual consent. You know, just highlighting that stark contrast and really questioning people, you know, which one of those societal organizations do you want our country more to reflect?
Well, in part, though, I would say, I would tag on to that thought, is that part of the conflict, and I don't want to use that word really, but part of the need for shows like this and for organizations like Civitas comes about because somebody needs to be telling people, wait a minute, look what the government's doing. Don't you want to keep more of your money? Don't you want to have an easier path to entrepreneurship and being able to live your life in freedom and harmony, as Tucker points out? So it's almost like conflict is something that is sometimes unavoidable, because if there are no voices, then the government is just going to run us over.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what, you know, in past years has certainly frightened people, where we hear rumors of government wanting to censor the internet, government wanting to, I think it's called the Fairness Doctrine, you know, dealing with radio.
Right.
And that's really revealing. You know, I think it's the people who feel threatened by these sound arguments about individual liberty versus, you know, government control. They feel threatened, and they know that they don't have a sound argument to counter with. So instead of countering speech with more speech and better arguments, they counter by trying to silence you.
Right. And that's the government really to do that.
Absolutely. And that's really what's frightening. So, you know, thank goodness we've still been able to, and I think especially the younger generation, if they're going to push back the hardest, because they're growing up, they don't know a world without a million websites that they can just access the click of a button. And, you know, there's so many tons of radio shows and podcasts and so much variety. You know, there's, you know, what was the old saying? There's an app for that.
Yeah.
You know, you got something in the palm of your hand. You can just call up just about anything you want.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's how they've grown up. That's the only world they know. And so if the government now is going to come in and try to threaten that, that's going to be so now foreign to them. I think there'll be a significant backlash, especially amongst the younger generation.
Well, what's interesting, kind of to put a bow on that, is I saw a thing on one of the social media sites earlier today where a protester was holding a sign that says, "Patriotism is racism." And, you know, I was thinking about that, and the absurdity of that comment is really almost endless, because if you are someone who is trying to have an involvement in some type of lifestyle, for example, that might not be mainstream, you're living in a country that's free. You should be celebrating patriotism and the fact that we're not in a Middle Eastern place that might kill people whose behaviors don't correspond with what that particular government thinks they should. And so the idiocy of that statement really, to me, is striking. And people, I don't think, seem to appreciate what we have here.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when you look at issues like that, look at the nations that had the strongest central government, top down societal structures, and look at how, for instance, ethnic minorities or religious minorities, mm-hmm. And other such minorities are treated in those countries. Those are where they're treated the worst.
Yeah,
you know, it's in the more freedom oriented, free markets type societies where, obviously no society is going to be perfect, but they're treated far better than they would under the alternative.
Yeah.
And so I think they're, these folks may be kind of shooting themselves in the foot, begging for bigger, stronger, more intrusive government, thinking that's going to help them as a minority, racial or other type of minority. Those type of countries are the ones that really treat their ethnic minorities the worst because they can get away with it.
Yeah.
Because why not? They're the government and they can strong arm people. And there's nothing the people can really do.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always marveled, as we kind of wrap this up, at the media. I always wonder, why are they so in love with liberalism? Because if you extrapolate liberalism out to its final ultimate end, you go through socialism and then you end up with communism, which is a strong government and limited freedom of the press. Yeah. And so it's like, if you're in the media, would you want all of a sudden not to have freedom of the press that you enjoy now? It's really, it doesn't make any sense.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, there is no freedom of the press. There's no freedom of speech without recognition of private property rights.
Yeah.
I mean, private property, you can own your newspaper, you can own the printing presses.
Yeah.
Without that in a, taking it to the extreme in a communist socialist, country, it's the government that owns those things.
Sure.
So you're no longer going to have a free press. You're going because you are not allowed to own the printing press anymore. So yeah. You're going to print what the government tells you to print.
Yeah.
Same thing with, radio stations and news stations or TV stations, I should say, and the internet and the modern age. I mean, if you're someone who's, who cares at all about the freedom of expression and freedom of speech, which, these people rioting, marching, protesting in the streets, they're claiming the mantle of free speech, but the society, the ultimate end game of the societies they seem to be advocating, completely stamps out any freedom of speech.
Yeah.
So, but they really are struggling to make those connections.
I don't think they've thought it all the way
through. No, I don't think so.
And by the way, if you need some extra income, I think you can make $1,500 to go and protest, and Craigslist has some ads for.
There you go, some capitalism being injected into communist protesters.
Yeah. So anyway, Brian Balfour, good stuff. We always appreciate the insight that you bring to our program, and thanks again for being our guest.
All right. Thank you, Mark.
All right. Well, thanks to Brian Balfour and to Garrett Ventry, our guest today on What Matters in North Carolina. Check us out in the iTunes and Google Play stores, and also tell your friends and family to listen to the show here at freedomactionnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, and we will be back tomorrow on What Matters in North Carolina.